Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, January the 8th, 2021. Section A. Midland Health. COVID vaccine not sitting on shelves. Midland Health begins administering second doses of COVID-19 vaccine. By Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. Midland Health began administering second doses of Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine on Tuesday after distributing initial doses to 2,316 employees and other frontline workers in the last few days. The vaccine is 95% effective at protecting recipients from getting sick from the coronavirus after two doses have been administered, according to hospital officials. "We're thrilled about it," said Val Sparks, Midland Memorial Hospital's infection preventivist. She said 881 Midland Health employees have received an initial dose of the vaccine, and the other 1,435 doses were given to hospital workers who are not employees, such as independent practitioners and others on the front lines. That includes healthcare providers, funeral directors, county jail employees, and city EMS workers. Midland County Judge Terry Johnson also said Thursday that he has received the vaccine. They've administered 400 second doses as of Thursday morning, according to MMH CEO and President Russell Myers. Sparks said they will continue vaccinating all who received an additional dose over the next 10 days. She said they've also distributed 65 initial doses of the Moderna vaccine. The 2,316 doses were from the shipment Midland Health received on December 17th. They were shipped enough vials for 1,950 doses, but found each vial had an extra dose. She said all the doses in that shipment were administered before the end of 2020. It is unknown when the next shipments will arrive, though Sparks said once they do, Midland Health will continue administering the vaccine to frontline workers as well as those who qualify for Phase 1B, which is open to individuals 65 and older or with chronic health conditions. The state's COVID-19 vaccine dashboard, which is supposed to show how many vaccine doses have been shipped and how many have been administered in each county, is lagging, according to hospital officials. The dashboard shows that about 1,000 vaccine doses have been administered in Midland County, less than half what Midland Health alone reports administered. You may have heard reports from people with state health services suggesting that hospitals have vaccines sitting on shelves and are not moving rapidly enough to get it administered, Myers said. I think by and large that's probably not true. It's not true here. Sparks said part of the delay in the state's reporting is from the state giving Midland Health an incorrect vendor ID number to use for their reporting. "We started entering data into one code, and the state called us and said, 'That's the wrong code for you. Stop,' she said. 'That was over the holidays. We kept going. Okay, tell us what to use.' And they would not answer us because they were closed for the holidays. We weren't given the correct code from the state until December 30th. She said she believes that's been a common problem throughout the Texas because other hospitals have complained about the same issue. Sparks said she did not know of any employees who called out of work after receiving the vaccine. The most common reaction reported from the vaccine is a sore arm. Myers said Thursday he had received a second dose of the vaccine 2 days earlier and felt mildly ill the following day, though it soon passed. "In my case, I had some chills and I felt a little bit fatigued. I took a couple of Tylenol and it went away. We've been told to expect that. That's an indication that the vaccine is working, that your body's reacting to it and getting a little bit of the symptoms of what the illness might be like because your body is reacting and building antibodies." Family of Odessa shooting victim has mixed feelings after seller gets 2 years in prison. By Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. The sister of an Odessa shooting victim said her family had mixed feelings after the man who sold the AR-15 rifle used to kill seven people on August 31st, 2019, was sentenced to 2 years in prison on Thursday. "There's nothing but sadness and utter senselessness in all of this," said Carla Byrne, the sister of 40-year-old Joe Griffith. Griffith was killed when Seth Aaron at Ator went on a shooting rampage that began in Midland and ended when Ator was shot and killed by police outside Odessa's Synergy movie theater. Marcus Anthony Brazil of Lubbock pleaded guilty in October to unlicensed firearms dealing and lying on federal tax returns. He admitted during an FBI and ATF investigation to selling Ator a gun in 2016 that he used to kill 7 and wound 25 3 years later. "While we are glad Marcus Brazil did not get just probation, we struggle with 2 years being sufficient in light of the fact that Joey received a death sentence and we feel as though we are serving life," Byrne said. She said she feels compassion for Brazil's wife and daughter, but he will be released in time to see his daughter graduate college and walk her down the aisle, Byrne said, and Griffith won't get to do that with his daughter. And 15-year-old Leila Hernandez, who was also killed in the shooting, will never graduate from high school. Ator was prohibited from purchasing firearms because of mental health issues, according to news reports. He circumvented a background check by purchasing a rifle from Brazil in a private sale. Private sales without background checks are legal in Texas if the seller is not profiting significantly from selling firearms. Brazil, however, was engaged in the business of selling firearms and illegally manufacturing guns, according to news reports. It was reported he had customers sign a paper attesting that they were not barred from obtaining a firearm. "And now he is stunned that the bad guy lied on the form," Byrne said. "What did he think would happen?" Brazil stated publicly that he was charged, after he was charged, that he regrets his actions and now supports universal background checks. Byrne suggested he show he's sincere by working with her to pass gun reform laws when he leaves prison. "If that's genuine, I propose to Marcus that he come find me when he's out of jail and agree to work with me to pass common sense gun legislation. I propose that he join me in speaking with senators to effect change. It's time to take H.R. 8 off the shelf, give it a good dusting, and bring it back to the Senate floor." H.R. 8 would require universal background checks with an exemption for family-to-family sales. It passed with bipartisan support in the U.S. House 5 months before the Odessa shooting, but has not been considered by the Senate. Byrne said she thought it would be powerful if she and Brazil were to partner to advocate for gun reform. "I challenge him to have the spine to do that," she said. "And if he doesn't, I'll know that he's only sorry he got caught and that his newfound respect for background checks is disingenuous." In August 2020, Griffith's and Hernandez families filed a lawsuit against Brazil and Anderson Manufacturing, the company that allegedly sold firearms and gun parts to Brazil. Byrne said they will move forward with the lawsuit because the goal is to elevate the importance of universal background checks. Community Worship Center to provide 500 free meals, by J.C. Lewis, jacy.lewis@hurstnp.com. The Community Worship Center will be giving out 500 free meals to community members on Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. at 2300 Butternut Lane. Edward Mayberry, senior pastor at Community Worship Center, said the church is modeling the event after the story in the Bible where Jesus feeds the 5,000, but instead of 5,000, their goal is to feed 500 people. "A few weeks ago, Mayor Peyton invited me to a Zoom meeting with some other clergymen, and he was walking us through some of the challenges COVID has caused. One of the major challenges was families going without food. He challenged us as clergymen and pastors to try to help support families who need food." Mayberry said the mayor has been a champion through the pandemic, including the December 8 call to action, and that he has continued to communicate with Peyton through email. "If he gets us on the phone again and has another plan or another direction that he wants us to pivot to, then we will do that. We're always up to any challenge that we think we can meet. With the help of God and our community, we are always up for it." Mayberry said he took the plan back to his church and they created the Operation 500 plan. The church will be passing out plates with pancakes, sausage, oatmeal, and a drink in a drive-thru at the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center parking lot. During the summer, the Community Worship Center works with MISD to hand out plates to students. This event will be the first food-giving outreach since the pandemic began. Every summer, we do this big event called Community Fest, where we give away backpacks and we have food, Mayberry said. It ends up being a fun event to end the summer. It was canceled this year due to the COVID, and with this event, we wanted it to be a time where families could put out tables and sit, but when talking to the health department, they advised us not to have that style of event. Latoya Mayberry, Edward's wife and co-pastor at Community Worship Center, said they decided to serve breakfast because it's the most important meal of the day. We want to do more, she said, so we may hit people up again with breakfast or we might do lunch. We always give free clothes away, so we're just trying to help meet the needs. Attendees don't have to bring any financial papers to receive a free breakfast. Food will be prepared by Tiara Jackson from Tubby's Mobile Kitchen. Even though it's a challenge that COVID brought, it is a blessing that we're able to still meet people's needs in a different way. Edward said the church is also trying to find funding to pay medical expenses for people living in Southeast Midland that have incurred medical expenses during the pandemic. He said the church has adopted the southeast side of Midland as their community because these are the people they serve and where they host events. I think it serves two purposes, he said. One, it eliminates the obligations on citizens who can't pay back for something that they never saw coming, but also helps our medical team as well as our hospital to be able to recapture some of the money that they spent trying to make sure that everybody stays safe. We are still looking at the best way to do that, but I think it will be a big help to our community. Mayor Payton saddened by CUD's participation in Capitol riot, from staff reports. Midland Mayor Patrick Payton addressed the participation of a former mayoral candidate in the riot at the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday. Payton talked in a United Command Team press conference Thursday, said the following of the participation of Midland's Jenny CUD in the riot, "It saddens me, and that's just as far as I'm willing to comment on that. It saddens me." He also said the upheaval was an indication of how bad 2020 has been, whether it's rioting that broke out with Black Lives Matter protests or storming the Capitol. Violent protesters on both sides of the aisle, he said. Protesters marched to Capitol Hill following President Donald Trump's speech in front of the White House as Congress was debating the Electoral College results of the presidential election. In his speech, Trump repeated unproven allegations of election fraud and told his supporters to march to the Capitol. CUD ran against Payton and Jerry Morales for mayor in November 2019. She picked up 15% of the vote. In 2020, CUD was active in protests in Midland and Odessa against business closures and potential mask mandates having to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. On Wednesday, CUD went on to social media multiple times to comment about what was taking place and her actions during the events at the U.S. Capitol. Midlander Eliel Rosa also participated, according to CUD's postings. In an interview with the Reporter Telegram on Thursday, CUD denied doing anything unlawful during the riots at the Capitol. She said that, unbeknownst to her, individuals with Antifa broke through barriers and assaulted police officers before she arrived. CUD said she then walked into the Capitol with a large group and took pictures inside the rotunda for about 15 minutes before leaving. She said she did not go into the House or Senate floors or into any lawmakers' offices. The group of Trump supporters marched to the Capitol with the goal of peacefully assembling in a show of solidarity, according to CUD. She condemned the violence incited by some protesters.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, January 8, 2021. Taking the oath. Midland County District Attorney Laura Noldolf take her oath of office from Judge Dean Rucker Monday in the Midland County 142nd District Courtroom. Farmers Market kicks off Saturday. The Midland Downtown Farmers Market will kick off its 2021 season Saturday on the back lawn of the Museum of the Southwest. The time for the market is 9 a.m. to noon. Markets will be held January 9 and 23, February 6 and 20, and March 6 and 20. LNOL available for private visits. The LNOL Art Museum is providing private access to the museum with its Book Your Bubble initiative. Private visits can be booked for $20 for up to 5 people or less, and for $40 for up to 10 people or less. Bubble visits are scheduled for an hour and are available through March 7. Visitors can view Betrothed, 250 Years of Wedding Fashion, from the Stephen Porterfield Collection. The museum will still be open during normal hours and free to the public. The ENAM is still following CDC guidelines by requesting all visitors to wear masks, practice social distancing, and regularly sanitizing all areas. Visits can be reserved by contacting Faye Batch at 432-553-9696, extension 211. J.C. Lewis, Reporter Telegram. Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of two. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. How sick are you? Midland Memorial Hospital offers a nurse triage program, 68 Nurse. The program is designed to help people determine whether their health situation warrants a trip to the emergency room. Midland residents can call the line by dialing 686-8773. The program is free and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Local nurses are available to help you determine the best place to receive care for your situation. 68 Nurse can help you save time and money by directing you to the most appropriate healthcare option. Whether it's a neighborhood clinic, urgent care center, emergency room, or just staying home. Today in history. Today is Friday, January 8, the 8th day of 2021. There are 357 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history. On January 8, 1998, Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, was sentenced in New York to life in prison without the possibility of parole. On this date, in 1815, the last major engagement of the War of 1812 came to an end as U.S. forces defeated the British in the Battle of New Orleans, not having gotten word of the signing of a peace treaty. In 1918, President Woodrow Wilson outlined his 14 points for lasting peace after World War I. Mississippi became the first state to ratify the 18th Amendment to the Constitution, which established prohibition. In 1935, rock and roll legend Elvis Presley was born in Tupelo, Mississippi. In 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson, in his State of the Union address, declared an unconditional war on poverty in America. In 1968, the Otis Redding single, Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay, was released on the Volt label almost a month after the singer's death in a plane crash. In 1973, the Paris peace talks between the United States and North Vietnam resumed. In 1982, American Telephone and Telegraph settled the Justice Department's antitrust lawsuit against it by agreeing to divest itself of the 22 Bell System companies. In 1994, Tonya Harding won the Ladies U.S. Figure Skating Championship in Detroit, a day after Nancy Kerrigan dropped out because of the clubbing attack that had injured her right knee. The U.S. Figure Skating Association later stripped Harding of the title. In 1997, the state of Arkansas put three men to death in the second triple execution since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976. The first also occurred in Arkansas in 1994. In 2004, a U.S. Black Hawk medevac helicopter crashed near Fallujah, Iraq, killing all 9 soldiers aboard. In 2006, the first funerals were held in West Virginia for the 12 miners who died in the Sago mine disaster 6 days earlier. In 2008, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton powered to victory in New Hampshire's 2008 Democratic primary in a startling upset, defeating Senator Barack Obama and resurrecting her bid for the White House. Senator John McCain defeated his Republican rivals to move back into contention for the GOP nomination.
The opinion page. To those who rioted in the Capitol, it was wrong. On Thursday morning, KWEL commentator Craig Anderson told his audience that it was wrong for people to storm the U.S. Capitol. I want to give Anderson credit for taking a stance when there are so many wanting to somehow justify what happened Wednesday because not much damage took place, or because other people or groups have done worse in their protesting, rioting, mob-like activities. Anderson, I believe, represents where most Midlanders come from when describing the assault on the Capitol. Still, it is not always easy to come out and say what those people, no matter who they are, did was wrong. And it was wrong. Our country is better than what was shown on Wednesday, and our people are better than the lawlessness on display when the storming of the Capitol took place. This newspaper will be discussing this topic of moving forward in upcoming opinion articles. But today, let all Midlanders agree our community should be united in that while we can disagree, there is no solution that involves rioting or the type of horrifying disregard for the law that we saw Wednesday or other times in 2020. In no uncertain terms, those that participated in the lawlessness on display Wednesday should be made an example of. It is the exact same of my expectations for those who participate in any type of unlawful destruction of property in cities across the nation. There are people who believe this newspaper glorified the actions of a Midlander that participated in the rioting at the Capitol and then broadcast on social media about her actions. The intent was to let you know that a Midlander was part of an event that is now part of our country's history, and offer, in her words, her experience and reasoning. Actions have consequences, and those people, including those from Midland who crossed the line on Wednesday, might have to come to terms with those actions. But moving forward, like Anderson, we also owe it to ourselves, our community, and our country to call out those who encourage, participate, or justify actions like we saw this week. Stuart Doreen, Storeen at HearstMP.com. Trump has shown indifference to mayhem. A commentary by Hugh Hewitt, special to the Washington Post. Abraham Lincoln took office in 1861 as genuine war clouds loomed, a far, far worse situation than the storming of the Capitol by lawless rioters Wednesday. Lincoln had arrived at the nation's city from Illinois by a roundabout route for fear of assassination along the way. He closed his first inauguration this way. "We are not enemies, but friends," he said. "We must not be enemies." Lincoln was not naive. He understood the deep divides in the still young United States, but implored everyone to step back from the brink of violence. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again untouched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Those moderating forces, which proved impossible to summon in Lincoln's day, have been largely missing from our country for 4 years, since the shock of the election of President Donald Trump. Hyper-partisans have waged virtual campaigns against one another, and sometimes the virtual violence turned real. Often the police and other authorities have hung back and allowed looting and lawlessness to go unpunished. At other times, the police themselves have been the targets of attack, some physical and much verbal. While Trump supporters gathered in the District of Columbia this week to stop the steal, it is hard to imagine that more than a tiny fraction intended violence. But some surely did, and they chose their moment with fierce intent. Congress had gathered to certify the election of President-elect Joe Biden, a ceremonial process that has in recent cycles, on occasion, developed a counterpoint ritual of objection and debate. but the objectors in 2004 or 2016 did not object on behalf of a contender so indifferent to the facts of the vote counts, court decisions, and public opinion as Trump. I do not believe the president intended today's riot. It has done him and his hopes for a future political comeback great damage. If he did not foresee what the people in the outer fringes of his support were capable of, he should have seen it. As it unfolded, he ought to have been quick to condemn it, and he should have done so without any sort of mention of his own grievances. His subsequent evening tweet, since taken down by Twitter, bordered on incomprehensible indifference to the mayhem of the day and the death that is a consequence of the violence. He ought to have be filled with remorse. The president stoked emotions, even as Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican Texas, and others were set to object to the certification of some Electoral College votes and air the grievances he alleges. Before they could make their case, the mob struck. The country is shamed. The criminals should be prosecuted. Trespassing at the Capitol and menacing elected representatives are crimes. Examples must be made so it cannot happen again. Still, we must be friends, not enemies. Every terrorist who has menaced public officials in public places and every thug who threatens a journalist or a peaceful protester is of a piece, and that piece is anti-American. Our leaders are supposed to be examples, not provocateurs. They must calm, not inflame. Networks addicted to cringe-inducing shout-fests between Trump, derangement, syndrome-suffering pundits, and blind to his faults, Trump apologists are culpable. 2, for the atmosphere of mutual contempt. Nearly all of the nearly 75 million who voted for Trump and all of the 81 million who voted for Biden have more in common than either do with the violent fringe to right or left. But the president and his most hate-filled opponents across the aisle, the media, and operatives feast on division. Even today, slandering all Trump supporters as enablers of Wednesday's mob is as wrong as slandering all protesters of the murder of George Floyd as looters and arsonists. This disturbing episode will make Trump's exit from Washington an occasion of general relief. The country will carry on. Before the riot on Wednesday, I had been Megyn Kelly's guest on her podcast. I said to her then, and would repeat now, we are blessed to be alive in the best country in which to live. That remains true through the stress of a shameful day and through the sorrows of a pandemic. Shame on everyone who breached the peace, and shame on those who maligned those who did nothing of the sort. If we are to be friends, it has to begin with careful discrimination between those on the fringe who embrace violence and the 99% of Americans who reject it. This is all Trump's fault. A commentary by Mark Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group. At his Georgia rally Monday night, President Donald Trump predicted the state's Senate runoffs. If Republicans lose, they're going to blame Trump. Well, it appears they did lose, and it is his fault. After the November election, Trump had two responsibilities: distribute the new coronavirus vaccines quickly and efficiently, and save the Republican Senate majority. He failed at both. Vaccine distribution has been an inexcusable disaster. And on Tuesday, Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican, lost to Raphael Warnock, Democrat, a man who declared Americans could not serve both God and the military, while former Senator David Perdue, Republican, is currently trailing Democratic challenger John Ossoff by more than 17,000 votes. This is a catastrophe. If Perdue does lose, Democrats will preside over a one-party state. They can eliminate the filibuster and pass radical legislation without compromise or concessions. They will have the power to pack the courts, raise taxes, go on an unprecedented spending spree, and lock in their Senate majority by making the District of Columbia a state, giving them two safe seats. The only thing standing in their way is the hope that Senator Joe Manchin, the third Democrat, West Virginia, will stand with Republicans against his party's president, majority leader, and House Speaker. Good luck with that. As the leader of the Republican Party, it was Trump's responsibility to prevent this outcome. He should have been campaigning nonstop for Perdue and Loeffler over the past 6 weeks. But instead, by his own admission, he focused 125% of my energy on his pathological campaign to reverse the results of the 2020 election. Not only did he barely lift a finger to help Loeffler and Perdue, he actively undermined them. When Congress finally passed a $900 billion stimulus package, the senators should have been able to take credit for delivering emergency relief to struggling Georgians. Instead, Trump called the $600 stimulus checks in the bill his own administration negotiated ridiculously low and demanded $2,000 checks, which had no chance of approval in the GOP-controlled Senate. Biden seized on Trump's blunder, promising Georgia voters that if they gave Democrats control of the chamber, the $2,000 checks would go out immediately. Trump also put Loeffler and Perdue in an impossible bind by vetoing the defense authorization bill, which included a 3% military pay raise. Georgia has 8 military bases and one of the country's largest populations of active duty service members. Loeffler and Perdue should have been able to campaign on delivering for military families. Instead, the president forced them to choose between angering those military families by sustaining Trump's veto or angering Trump's loyal base by overriding it. So they skipped the vote, angering both. Worst of all, Trump dampened Republican enthusiasm by insisting the elections in Georgia are rigged. He declared on Twitter that the Georgia Senate races were illegal and invalid. His presidential campaign ran an ad in Georgia the week before the runoff, not to promote Loeffler and Perdue, but urging voters to demand state legislators overturn the November election. Even at his Monday rally, the first words Trump uttered were, "There's no way we lost Georgia. That was a rigged election." Many Georgian Republicans believed his conspiracy mongering and stayed home. According to the Cook Political Report, turnout in Whitfield County, where Trump held his rally, was 86% of November levels, below the statewide turnout of 89% of November levels. If Trump were trying to depress GOP turnout, he could not have done a better job. Some have speculated that it is exactly what he was doing, that he really didn't want Loeffler and Perdue to prevail, because if they won, while he lost, it would have proven that the election was not rigged and that Georgia voters rejected him. Whether the intentional or incompetent, his self-absorbed conduct over the past 6 weeks has been disastrous. He has driven away anyone willing to tell him the truth, that he lost a winnable election because he alienated too many Americans, and has surrounded himself with sycophants and enablers who indulge his penchant for conspiracy theories. He has shirked his responsibility to provide over a smooth presidential transition and the effective distribution of vaccines. And now he may have delivered Democrats the power to reverse his legacy and irreversibly transform our country. After he lost, I urged him in this space to focus on winning back the presidency in 4 years. If he led the GOP to victory in Georgia, it would have been the first step of his political restoration. But if he handed Democrats control of the Senate, he would go down in ignominy. The choice was his. He chose ignominy. And now America may pay the price.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, January 8th, 2021. Section A. Gun seller sentenced for unlicensed firearms dealing. The man who sold the AR-15 used to kill 7 people and injure 25 others in Midland and Odessa, August 31st, 2019, has been sentenced to 2 years in federal prison, U.S. Attorney Aaron Neely Cox announced in a news release. Marcus Anthony Brazil, 45, of Lubbock, pleaded guilty in October to one count of dealing firearms without a license and one count of subscribing to a false tax return. He was sentenced Thursday to 24 months in federal prison by U.S. District Judge James Wesley Hendricks, the release said. Federal firearm laws, including those that mandate background checks by licensed dealers, ensure that guns don't fall into the hands of prohibited persons, Cox said in the release. By subverting those laws, Mr. Brazil enabled a deranged mass shooter. We hope this case sends a message. The U.S. Department of Justice will not give unlicensed dealers a pass. To do so would endanger our communities. Knowingly dealing firearms without a license is a significant crime and often leads to extreme violence. In this particular case, Mr. Brazil's acts were implicit in the murders of 7 innocent victims. In subverting the law, an individual otherwise prohibited from obtaining firearms was able to purchase a gun from Mr. Brazil. ATF will continue to do whatever necessary to keep the firearms out of the hands of those who should not have them. ATF Special Agent in charge of the Dallas Field Office, Jeffrey C. Boschek II, said in the release. According to plea papers, Mr. Brazil admitted he sold Midland Odessa shooter Seth Aaron Ader an AR-15-style rifle October 8, 2016, nearly 3 years before Ader used the gun to murder 7 people and wound 25 more, the release said. Ader, who had been adjudicated mentally defective and was therefore legally prohibited from possessing firearms, first attempted to purchase a gun from a sporting goods store, but was rejected after the National Instant Criminal Background Check System flagged his mental status. He later circumvented the NICS system by purchasing a gun from Brazil, who elected not to run background checks on any of his buyers, the release said. Background checks are not necessarily required for in-state private transfers. However, Mr. Brazil admitted he was engaged in the business of selling firearms, repeatedly devoting time and attention to purchasing and reselling guns for pecuniary gain, and thus should have been licensed and conducting background checks. In his plea papers, Mr. Brazil admitted he routinely bought firing mechanisms, termed lower receivers, used milling equipment to build them into full-fledged guns, and then sold the completed weapons for roughly $100 to $200 profit. He said he typically listed his firearms for sale on armslist.com and conducted the sales in the parking lot of a local sporting goods store or out of his garage. In a 4-year span, Mr. Brazil inadvertently sold firearms to 4 prohibited persons: a convicted felon, a man under felony indictment, an immigrant in the U.S. illegally, and Mr. Ader, a man who the courts deemed unfit to possess a firearm. Agents traced the lower receiver of the gun Mr. Brazil sold to Mr. Ader to Mulehead Dans, a federally licensed firearm dealer in Lubbock. The owner of Mulehead Dans confirmed that Mr. Brazil often purchased lower receivers and firearms there. In addition to concealing his unlicensed dealing, Mr. Brazil admitted he also concealed the income from his firearm sales from the IRS. IRS-CI is dedicated to using the full strength of the federal government to ensure strict and lengthy sentences for those who violate our country's tax laws. In this case, Mr. Brazil made illegal business decisions, directly contributing to the death and injury of multiple civilians, and today's sentence reflects the court's acknowledgement of this preventable tragedy, stated IRS-CI Acting Special Agent in Charge Mark Pearson, Dallas Field Office, who praised the joint efforts of the IRS-CI agents and their federal partners. Mr. Brazil has been ordered to self-surrender to the Federal Bureau of Prisons by April 7, 2021. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, IRS Criminal Investigations Division, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Homeland Security Investigations, the United States Postal Inspection Service, the Texas Department of Public Safety, and the Lubbock Police Department conducted the investigation. Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Haig, NDTX's West Texas branch chief, is prosecuting the case. Vital training. OPA recruits collect wealth of firearms training by Royal McGregor. Recruits in the 21st session of the Odessa Police Academy, OPA, entered firearms training with varying degrees of knowledge. On one hand, 34-year-old Odessan Jody Baer had plenty of practice with firearms as he spent 4 years in the Army, while 39-year-old Lenya Alonso from Miami said she went to the shooting range a couple times prior to joining the police academy. Baer said despite his previous practice with firearms, the training he is receiving in OPA is vastly different from what he was taught in the Army. When you are in the Army, you are taught to be more aggressive, said Baer, who was a 2004 graduate of Permian High School. In police training, you are not. You are taught the value of human life, and the pistol is your last resort. You have to be on target every time because you can't have a random stray shoot off. You have to be in control of yourself and make sure everything you do is right on the money. In addition to firearms training, Alonso said she is also practicing her stance and breathing techniques. Recruits spent Thursday morning firing their respective Sig Sauer P320 40 caliber handguns from standing, kneeling, and prone positions. You have to be very respectful of your deadly weapon, she said, being prepared for different scenarios and how to handle them. It prevents casualties. Odessa Police Department Sergeant Tommy Jones, training coordinator for OPA, said firearm training is important for recruits, as the use of their firearm should be their last resort. We tell them that if they are going to pull their gun out, which is their last resort, and you have to fire, you have to be aware of your surroundings, Jones said. You have to make sure there's nothing else and no one else that can be by that round that they are firing. OPA has about 2 months left before graduation takes place at 3 p.m. March 5th at the Odessa Marriott Center and Convention Center. Baer said it will be crucial for recruits not to get complacent during the final stretch of the academy. There are a total of 11 recruits in the 21st session of OPA, with six of them from Odessa and one from Midland. This last month is probably going to be the most important going through the academy, because the first few months you are learning everything, and now you see the light at the end of the tunnel, Baer said. You can't let your guard down on anything. You have to be focused on your studies, all of your physical training, and you can't let yourself slide. Members of the OPA 21st session: Lenya Alonso, 39, Miami. Jody Baer, 34, Odessa. Tyler Bullard, 22, Odessa. Jocelyn Chapa, 27, Del Rio. Salmon Mariwani, 30, Baghdad, Iraq. Dalton McSweeney, 23, Carlsbad, New Mexico. Mike Miller, 21, Odessa. Annette Rios, 28, Midland. Felipe Rodarte, 31, Odessa. Valley Thurman, 21, Odessa. Elizardo Vasquez, 24, Odessa. West Texans Witness History at Capitol by Royal McGregor and Ruth Campbell. West Texans were in Washington, D.C. this week to protest the results of the November 3rd election and to meet with members of Congress. Casey Gray, a native of Odessa, said that he was in the nation's capital with 200 other Texans. He said he met with five congressmen, including newly elected U.S. Representative August Pfluger, Republican, Texas, on Tuesday. Gray said he talked with Pfluger for about an hour. 99.9% of the crowd were peaceful, Gray said. They were peaceful in the sense that they were there to be part of history. On the day of the protest, we were outside the Capitol in front watching it, Gray said Thursday. It was chaotic watching people, Gray said. We saw the Capitol police and they were very professional. They were overwhelmed, to be honest. Asked if there was any shift in mood between Tuesday and Wednesday, Gray said there wasn't any negativity. The people were around the shift was all about the same, Gray said. People were just there to be part of history. It was very positive. Former Midland mayoral candidate Jenny Cudd said she attended President Trump's speech early Wednesday morning and then made her way to the Capitol building. Cudd said she followed a couple people going up the stairs, and there was a door that was open that people were going in, and that's how she got inside. She said the question the media isn't asking is why 75 million are upset, and she claims that the election was stolen. I personally didn't break anything, Cudd said. I didn't break down any doors. I didn't do anything violent. No one that I saw had any weapons of any sort. Asked whether she is worried about the FBI, Cudd said she is not, because I know I didn't break the law, Cudd said. I know there are plenty of people in Midland and Odessa that have already turned me in to the FBI. When the FBI calls, I will talk to them. Midland Mayor Patrick Peyton, a supporter of Trump's policies, said he was disturbed Wednesday as he watched what was happening at the Capitol, regardless of who was involved in the events. He said it was a continuation of what was happening in 2020 when there was an opportunity for discussion of social and racial issues and electoral issues on both sides of the spectrum, but people took to extremes instead. What I'm deeply saddened by is it's not just the right, it's not just the left. It's an indication that we've somehow lost our moorings and leadership. We've got to find a way to understand each other before attacking one another, Peyton said. He cited a phrase from Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People that says, "Seek first to understand, then to be understood." On both sides of political aisle, we have abdicated debate and discussion around real issues, Peyton said. He added that he never thought that the election was going to be overturned. I thought it eventually ended the way it was going to end, but it had an interlude of great chaos that made it worse. Odessa High School seniors Aika Agirulukula and Sejal Yadala, both 17, said they were upset by Wednesday's events. It was really sad to see. It is all done. It's definitely just a small percentage of our population. And yeah, I just really never want to see anything like that again, Angirikula said. Yadala said the U.S. was founded on the idea that every person gets a vote. Every vote is counted, and all of those votes accumulate to come to a decision, and whatever that decision is, whoever's not happy makes peace with it, and whoever is happy, they can enjoy that for a few years. I think that it's sad that, politics aside, that our country as a whole has come to that conclusion that we need that further step to decide who the president is and step in front of the voice of the people. Because once you take away the voice of the people and the power holds, we take away the resource of the, we take away the essence of the country itself, Yadala said. Quick hit. Annual resolution run and walk. The Monahans Chamber of Commerce has scheduled the annual resolution 5K 10K run and health walk 9 a.m. Saturday at Sandhills State Park in Monahans. Registration starts at 8 a.m. Early registration is $20. Children and under is $15, and race day registration is $25. For more information, call 432-943-2187 or visit www.monahans.org or www.facebook.com/Monahans Sandhills. Pfluger proposes first piece of legislation. Washington, D.C. Late Wednesday, Congressman August Pfluger, Republican, Texas 11, introduced his first piece of legislation, the Saving America's Energy Future Act, which prohibits the Biden administration from declaring a moratorium on issuing new oil and gas permits for drilling on federal lands. Original co-sponsors include Representatives Tony Gonzalez, Texas 23, Stephanie Bice, Oklahoma 5, Ronnie Jackson, Texas 13, Yvette Harrell, New Mexico 2, Brian Babin, Texas 36, Chip Roy, Texas 21, Dan Crenshaw, Texas 2, Pat Fallon, Texas 4, and Jody Arrington, Texas 19. My primary concern in Congress is to protect our oil and gas industry from the radical Democrats who will soon control the House, Senate, and White House. President-elect Joe Biden campaigned on the promise to shut down drilling on all federal lands and phase out fossil fuels. This, in conjunction with ludicrous policies like the Green New Deal, could mean the end to our oil and gas industry and the American economy as we know it. The Permian Basin produces over 40% of our nation's energy. This is clean, affordable, reliable energy that powers our nation, heats our homes, and allows us to defend ourselves. Energy security is national security, and nothing could be more important, Pfluger said in a news release. Health officials refute claims of decreasing COVID cases by Federico Martinez. Odessa health officials Thursday strongly refuted claims made by several city council members this week that local COVID-19 cases have decreased significantly and pleaded with government leaders not to follow through with a tentative plan to repeal the city's current face covering ordinance. Officials from Odessa Regional Medical Center and Medical Center Hospital acknowledged that COVID cases have decreased slightly during a Thursday online press conference. Every day we're hearing that positive cases and deaths are going up, ORMC President Stacey Brown said. It's not getting better across the country. It's getting better here because of the mask mandate, but we're not out of the woods yet. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin added, the mask does work if the whole community makes an effort to make it work. If they do away with the masks, you're going to see another spike in the city and we'll go into another tailspin. During a Tuesday work session, a majority of Odessa City Council members publicly stated they would support rescinding the current mask ordinance, which requires all employees and customers to wear face coverings when they are inside a business. Those in support of eliminating the mandate included Mayor Javier Hoven, Denise Swanner, Tom Sprawls, and Mark Mata. Council members Steve Thompson, Detra White, and Mary Willis supported keeping the ordinance in place. But Hoven, who made the initial claim that COVID cases locally have decreased significantly, couldn't produce any evidence or data when pressed by several council members, including Mata. The council agreed not to vote on the ordinance issue until Hoven or city administrators could produce that data. COVID-19 rates have very slightly decreased in recent weeks, but are still cause for concern, Odessa Regional Medical Center Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan said. For example, throughout October and November, MCH housed an average of 70 COVID patients daily, and ORMC averaged 30 patients, hospital officials said. This week, MCH's inpatient numbers have dropped to the mid-60s, and ORMC reported a daily average of 30 patients. Saravanan also said it would be premature to lift the face covering mandate. It looks like overall hospitalization numbers have gone down a little bit, he said, but we're still waiting to see if we get a post-Christmas holiday spike. Former Mayor David Turner in November signed an ordinance that required the face coverings and limited business occupancy to 50% capacity. Turner made the decision after COVID cases were skyrocketing and state health officials were threatening to come in and impose their own sanctions. After numbers decreased, council in December rescinded the business capacity mandate but kept the face covering portion. MCH Thursday reported that they were housing 68 COVID-19 patients, with 12 of those patients in critical care, and 13 on ventilators. ORMC reported 24 patients, 15 in critical condition, and 9 on ventilators. ECISD employees receive COVID vaccinations by Ruth Kimball. In his first media call of the new year, Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray said educators have begun to get vaccinated against the COVID-19 virus. He said those 65 and older and staff members who have pre-existing medical conditions were targeted in this first round of shots. Speaking Wednesday over a Zoom call, Murray added that almost 500 staff members were vaccinated this week. Once a new shipment of vaccines comes in and the district is notified, more of ECISD's 4,200 employees will be able to get the shot. We have a lot of teachers and secretaries and support professionals, administrators who are eager to be vaccinated so that we can continue to serve the kids, Murray said. We fully anticipate that within days that the state will begin to issue their next set of guidance that will include all our teachers, not all our educators, not just teachers, but secretaries, support professionals, administrators in that list. And we expect that within days. Once those arrive in our community, our medical community, our hospitals or other health care providers are ready to administer those vaccines, Murray said. We as a staff are ready to receive that. We're primed and ready, just waiting on that shipment. He added that it makes him feel good that district educators and other employees have a chance to get the vaccine. Our educators have worked diligently, really, since last March, dealing with the pandemic, balancing their own health with the education of children. I know this is going to really create a significant sense of relief on the part of our educators, as well as bus drivers, cafeteria workers, and others who have direct contact with students. We're going to be relieved to have this additional layer of protection as we continue to serve the children of this community. So I'm thrilled for our educators and also grateful to our healthcare community. Our medical community has been very supportive of the work that we're doing, Murray said. There are plans to bring students back to school buildings who have not had an optimal experience with virtual learning, but Murray said the community positivity rate for COVID and the hospitalization rate has to come down first. But hopefully in the next several weeks, the medical situation in our community will improve and ECISD will begin to transition students who are in a virtual environment who are not experiencing success. Students who are making D's and F's, or students who are not attending school virtually on a daily basis, we will transition those students back into the regular learning environment, Murray said. There are students who have done well in the virtual environment who are making A's, B's, and C's and attending class regularly. Those students will be allowed to continue their virtual experience at least through the end of this school year, and we look forward to continuing to serve those students in that manner. In Texas, Murray said students have to attend school 90% or more of the time to receive credit. Some of our students are in jeopardy of not earning their credits for their courses simply because they haven't attended school enough, Murray said. The virtual environment for some of our students has been really challenging for them, and we would like to bring them back into the school environment so they can have a healthier academic experience. He added that whether students are virtual or face-to-face, the goal is success for every child. Murray also noted that January is School Board Appreciation Month. We would like to celebrate and honor the members of the ECISD Board of Trustees who give unselfishly of their time and energy to serve the 34,000 students in Ector County, the families in our community, and our staff members. Many do not know that school board service requires 10, 20, or even 30 hours a week of dedicated service on the part of our trustees. They are not paid for their positions, so they're really volunteers in those positions and work diligently to make sure that the needs of the children of our community are met, the needs of our staff are met, and the needs of our broader community are met academically.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.